Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today, I'll be joined on the show by Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The budget tracker for CQ Roll Call is reporting appropriators will return to Washington this week, jumping into what will likely be a six-week whirlwind in an attempt to avoid another government shutdown. A short-term stopgap funding bill runs until November 21st. Talks began over the October break to reconcile differences between the House and Senate spending allocations for all 12 appropriations bills for fiscal year 2020, which technically began October 1st. But there was no expectation of immediate compromise. The biggest conflict remains funding for a southern border wall, which is what led to the longest government shutdown in our nation's history last year. The House and Senate are far apart on the issue. The Senate's appropriations would provide $5 billion in wall funding, while the House would provide none. The House has passed 10 of its 12 bills, albeit along party lines and in excess of recently established spending levels. The Senate has passed none. House Democrats are still hoping a deal can be reached on legislation targeting prescription drug prices. The Ways and Means Committee will hold a hearing this week on the subject. The House and Senate have both offered bills related to the issue, and President Trump seems willing to strike a deal. The Congressional Budget Office has scored some of the proposed legislation. One particular bill would purportedly reduce deficits by $100 billion over 10 years. CBO estimated that the federal budget deficit for fiscal year 2019 was $984 billion, or 4.7% of GDP. That would be an increase of $205 billion over the deficit in fiscal year 2018 and the fourth consecutive increase. Final numbers should be available later this month. Spending grew by 8%, revenue grew by 4%, and interest on the debt increased by 14% to $423 billion. Up next, Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby will join me to discuss Concord's new fiscally responsible economic growth agenda. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby. You all know Bob pretty well. He's a regular contributor on the show. He fancies all things maple and can be spotted around town with a Tab diet soda in his hand. Welcome back to Facing the Future, Bob.
Thanks. That sounds really weird.
Cut. Start over. No. Today, we're going to talk about a new initiative with the Concord Coalition, a push for a fiscally responsible economic growth agenda, and that's a mouthful. So before we dive headlong into what that means, why don't you explain to our listeners why you think it's important that we go that route right now?
Well, this project originally came out of the thinking of, you know, we've been around for 27, 28 years now, and what has changed during that time? And, you know, how do we need to evolve with as the fiscal challenge has evolved? We still have an unsustainable fiscal track. It's still caused by rising health care and the aging of the population and revenues that don't keep up. So there's that structural gap is still there and growing. So that hasn't changed. There is another development that has changed that is contributes to the run up of debt and the long term projections of deficits and debt continuing, and that is that economic growth has slowed. And I don't mean in a temporary way and, you know, response to the business cycle or something like that. It's just the underlying trends of the economy are slower than they were, say, 30 years ago when the Concord Coalition started. We used to think of, you know, economic growth on average would grow at about 3% a year. And lately it's been more like 2.5% or 2% even. And the projections from CBO and the Federal Reserve and other nonpartisan economists all seem to indicate that they're projecting less than 2% economic growth per year. Now, that's a big change, and it makes the fiscal situation even worse. Digging out of a big fiscal hole when you've got a slow-growing economy is even more difficult. So we thought, look, we still have to do all the things that we've talked about in terms of controlling health care costs and reforming Social Security to make it sustainably solvent. We also should look at things that would enhance economic growth. And again, I'm not talking about short-term stimulus. We all know you could have a big spending program or you could cut taxes. Congress is good at that sort of thing. and you will, as we saw with the tax cut a couple of years ago, you will see a spurt in the short term in economic growth. But it's just like a shot of adrenaline. It wears off, and then, you know, you're back to this underlying trend, which is getting slower. So that was the genesis of it, to look at what policies could we add to the mix that would help with economic growth.
So that is a good segue into what I think should be the next topic of discussion, and that is, what is a fiscally responsible economic growth agenda? And it might be important to explain, Bob, why we're seeing a slowdown in the growth in the economy, because I think that factors into this particular agenda that Concord has come up with.
Yeah, we looked at, you know, that was the next question, was having identified this slow growth phenomenon that, everybody can see it. It's like, well, why is that happening? And it really isn't a mystery. There, there's a good chart that we have in this project that's taken from the Congressional Budget Office that shows the decline in the growth of the workforce. It's not that we have a smaller workforce; it's just it's growing at a much slower rate.
Which I think is a key distinction, because going back even to the tax cut question or issue that you brought up, a big sort of misnomer is, well, tax cuts can increase revenue. Well, it's also revenue relative to a lot of other things. And I think the same could be said about workforce growth.
Yeah. I mean, the workforce is still growing, but it used to grow, let's say, around 1.5% a year, and the economy was growing at about 3%. And now the projection is about 0.5. So basically a third of the growth that we used to count on, and that's partially due to the retirement of the baby boomers and fewer new workers coming onto the scene.
Is that a sustained trend? Is that something expected to continue for decades, or is it a short spurt where it's just a temporary challenge?
Unless you and your cohorts start having a lot of babies, which
is... So we need a spike in fertility rate is what you're saying.
That could help, yes. It's unlikely. It is a longer-term trend. And so we are seeing that trend continue. So it's not just like it's like this sudden dearth. It's been a long-term trend. And the trend is for the workforce growth to stay lower than it was. The other is productivity. Now, if you're going to have, economic growth is basically dependent on workforce growth and the productivity of that workforce. So we already said workforce growth is about a third of what it was when we were growing at about 3% a year. And productivity is down slightly. At best, it's stagnant. It's not going up. So the bottom line for economic growth is, if you want to get anywhere back to 3% economic growth, the slower growing workforce is going to have to be much more productive.
This feels like, for me, the transition point that the nation and the economy might have been at a little over 25 years ago when the Concord Coalition and other organizations and individuals started warning of what would happen when the baby boom generation retires. And I think we're almost giving a similar warning in because of that generational shift and because millennials and younger generations are having fewer children and not building up the workforce as large as it was before. It's almost like we're looking ahead to the future and saying, here are some of the challenges that are going to come as a result of that. So it's a double whammy on both ends, but I think it's also a state of wanting to plan for the future and acknowledging what's going to be baked in as we get there. And with that in mind, what are some of the key issues that Concord focused on in this fiscally responsible economic growth agenda?
And just to reinforce the point that you made, I think that that's right. It's really looking at the consequences. You know, what are the problems? If the Concord Coalition started today, what issues would we look at? And that's the way I look at this project. Fiscal responsibility is itself an economic growth agenda because you can't continually borrow your way to prosperity. At some point,
can you say that again, just for the benefit of our listeners and elected leaders?
you can't have your whole economy based on perpetual borrowing, particularly when it's done to support consumption spending, which is basically what the federal budget does. So, what are the other elements besides fiscal responsibility? We looked at immigration. You know, we had five papers. I think you mentioned we did five papers in conjunction with some of the best known think tanks in Washington. We sort of picked their brains, you might say, to try to get them to address these issues and put forward some potential solutions. So one of them was immigration, which is if we have a problem with a slower growing workforce, one solution, aside from your generation having more babies, is to allow for a higher rate of legal immigration. And I want to distinguish, we don't get into the border fight and the wall and all that stuff. It's just from an economic perspective, can we use legal immigration policy to shore up one of these pillars of economic growth that is shrinking? And the answer is yes. We had a very good paper written by Doug Holtz-Eek and a former director of the Congressional Budget Office and his colleague Jackie Varis at the American Action Forum, and I think Jackie's been on the show, talking about a potential way to increase legal immigration, and that would help with economic growth. And thinking of immigration more as a economic growth strategy than it's thought of today. So that's one of the topics.
And Bob, before you jump into the remaining four, I just want to remind our listeners that we're talking to Bob Bixby, the executive director of the Concord Coalition, and they're listening to Bob on Facing the Future. We're discussing Concord's new fiscally responsible economic growth agenda, and we were just starting to really get into the substance of the proposal. Bob, you just mentioned immigration reform being one of the topics. And I know, like you said, there are four additional papers, four additional topics. And why don't you keep going down that track and let us know what those areas are?
Sure. So with the if you're going to expand the growth of the workforce, you also need to invest in that workforce. And that means investing in cutting edge technology that will help create the jobs of the future and make the workforce more productive, and also increase training for an evolving job climate, you might say, as the nature of the workforce changes. So we have two papers that address those issues. One is on recommending a much higher level of R&D spending on the part of the federal government. And It identifies some areas, and don't ask me to get into all of them because there's so much in these papers that I don't have them all right at my fingertips in terms of the details of them. But the gist of the paper is that the federal government should do a much better job targeting strategic investments for the future. And that means spending more in this area, which the Concord Coalition is perfectly happy with. Fiscal responsibility doesn't mean cutting everything across the board willy-nilly no matter what. It means...
You mean we're not about just gutting spending in the federal budget every which way?
No. some of it should be. It's an opportunity to look at what should we be spending less on. But this is an opportunity to spend more on investment. Like I said, most of the federal budget, over 70% of it, is really transfer payments from some people to other people.
So it's a way to try and set new or reinforce priorities.
Right, and to reorient some federal spending towards investment, which we think would help with the productivity part of the equation. And then there is the job training, worker training, because one of the byproducts of R&D spending and having new jobs is some jobs are going to go away, and new jobs are created. So your generation is, and the generations after you, are going to face a much different climate than in the workforce than, say, my generation did, or certainly my parents, the World War II generation.
I think we already are. At least in my generation, more people have a larger number of jobs throughout their career already, and we're only maybe a decade into working in being out of school. And I know several of my own colleagues and friends have already gone to two or three different places for work. And I can think of past generations, like my grandfather worked at the same company for I think almost 40 years, retired, got a pension, and he was done.
Yeah, that's the old classic. I just have to say, you get a lot of politicians running around saying that's the norm. I'm going to bring back the days, where you could go to work and, work in the same place in the factory for 40 years or 30 years and get your gold watch. But that doesn't reflect the changing nature of the workforce. And so we're going to have to be, the federal government is going to have to do its part by doing a better job of providing programs that would help with worker training and retraining, people having lifelong learning opportunities for changing technologies and just changing. I look back at jobs that when I was entering the workforce that just don't exist anymore.
I'm not going to venture a guess on what they
weren't buggy whips. I mean, let's not use that example, but there were.
We've talked about immigration reform. We've talked about a paper on R&D. We've talked about the need for workforce investment, worker training, retraining, which I think the latter is going to be very important. As you mentioned, technology having a role in all of this and completely revamping entire industries or eliminating them altogether, and you're going to have a lot of displaced workers. So I think the retraining piece is especially vital. I know there are two more subjects we want to get into here, but I want to save that for our next segment. And maybe before we go to that segment and jump into those two topics, which are big, healthcare and Social Security, maybe you can explain to our listeners really quickly when this project even kicked off. I think we sort of jumped over that at the outset of this and what we've done already to sort of get this information out there.
Well, the project really got its start over a year ago when we began talking with potential authors, identifying the subject areas that we wanted to address, and then really commissioning the papers to, you send out a statement of the paper that you're interested in and see who's interested in writing about it. And then over the past year, the authors were working on the papers, and we had various meetings with the authors and the authors meeting with each other to talk about how the papers were evolving and how they worked together. And they had an opportunity to review each other's papers. And we did kind of a rolling release, you might say. Four of the papers actually came out before we released them all together. And I think that was good because it gave an opportunity for the papers to get some individual attention. Like the immigration paper we released in Iowa back in the spring got a lot of attention. And the R&D paper, we had a Capitol Hill briefing in September for basically congressional staff, and that was terrific. The Social Security paper was released at an economic forum in Palm Beach, Florida. So that was that was not an accident.
That's a fitting location.
And the healthcare paper was released at the think tank in Washington in late September. We had three former CBO directors on a panel commenting on it. And I should mention that that was the last healthcare paper authored by the late Alice Rivlin, just a legend in the in the budget world, and she co-authored that paper with Joe Antos from AEI. And then we brought them all together for a joint policy forum on October 3rd, where we released all of the papers. They are together in a weighty book.
A weighty tome,
yes, which anybody can get by just contacting the Concord Coalition. But it is, I have it right in front of me. And
it hits with a thud, you know, both in policy and in real life when you drop it on a desk.
It's even got an overview paper of all these subjects explaining why they all go together from the Concord Coalition. And actually, I think it is a very exciting project because it not only talks about the important key issues, but puts forward some ideas for how to address them.
And I think I'd be reticent if I didn't say, if you don't want a physical copy of the book, which might have killed three or four trees, you can download it online from the Concord Coalition's website at concordcoalition.org. And certainly encourage our listeners to take a look at that. Some very interesting policy ideas. But we're going to come back in our next segment. We'll hear more. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby discuss Concord's new fiscally responsible economic growth agenda. And we'll be back after these short messages for more from Bob. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby, picking up from our last segment where we were discussing a fiscally responsible economic growth agenda that the Concord Coalition recently kicked off. There are five papers, five topics associated with that project. We discussed three of them in our last segment, and Bob will pick up on the remaining two. And I mentioned that those two subjects were healthcare and Social Security. So, Bob, grab the third rail of politics with both hands, and I'll let you pick which topic you want to start off with.
All right. Well, I will start off with healthcare and leave
healthcare for 500, please.
These are subject matters that the Concord Coalition has long been involved with because you cannot look at the future of the federal budget, hope to bring about a sustainable fiscal policy, and ignore the health care programs and Social Security. Between them, they're about half of federal spending, and I think health care programs have actually surpassed Social Security as the biggest portion of the federal budget if you add them all up. There are social Medicare and Medicaid and Obamacare and SCHIP, and there's a lot of them, but it's over $1 trillion. It's like about $1.2 trillion. So, and healthcare and Social Security are the programs that are growing faster than the economy. And that means they're taking up a bigger share of the budget every year and projected to grow at an unsustainable rate. Even though Social Security and Medicare have dedicated sources of revenue, which I think makes a lot of people think that they're paid for, quote unquote, and
insufficient dedicated sources of
and
revenue.
And so the money coming in through the payroll tax and Medicare premiums doesn't cover the cost, the full cost of the program. So the rest of that is, you know, born out of general revenues and adds to the deficit. So are, you know, these are related to economic growth in a couple of ways. One is just the contribution to running up the deficit. So, I mean, you really need to look at these programs, plus revenues, I would add, to see about getting a sustainable fiscal future. But these programs also have a lot to do with how people think and act on personal savings and work and decisions that they make, and that can have an effect on the economy. So for a new twist, we asked the authors, well, think about Social Security reform or Medicare reform or any sort of healthcare reform as an economic growth issue. So I but that having been said, let me drop back and look at the healthcare paper.
What a very political elected leader type answer, Bob. You went off on a tangent and didn't actually say what you were going to say.
That's right.
But I commend you for circling back around.
Well, yes. So long as you get back to the original question. So we asked, this is an important paper because we asked Joe Antos from AEI and Alice Rivlin from Brookings. And if, in case you don't know, one's a Democrat, one's a Republican. And both are healthcare experts to look at the future of healthcare spending and look at strategies for slowing the growth of healthcare spending. So we're not looking here at specifically, you know, do you just cut benefits or raise taxes? And it's really aside from the question of who pays. On the campaign trail, most of the question is about who pays.
I'm really glad you made that distinction because that has bothered me in this whole conversation about healthcare. Regardless of what overarching system our nation goes with, you know, whether we're at a turning point for some kind of universal system or beefing up the ACA or some other kind of reform that we haven't thought of yet, I think the missing piece in this conversation is how do you slow the cost growth issue versus who's paying for healthcare? Because if you don't tackle healthcare cost growth, whoever is paying a lot.
Well, exactly. And so what Alice and Joe did was put together, I think, a really outstanding, almost a primer, really, on strategies for controlling healthcare costs. You're not going to find like a blow-by-blow legislative description here, which I think this paper is really good because it talks about the role of competition, it talks about the role of consumer choice in the whole healthcare spending. It talks about an appropriate role for regulation where markets fail, and it talks about new ways of paying providers healthcare providers, doctors, hospitals that would help encourage efficiencies and not just quantity of services. So I would recommend it. I would recommend it to the candidates, too, as a good way to look at it. Because, as you said, no matter who pays, we have to look at a more efficient way of providing health care. So that was the health care paper. On the Social Security paper, the authors came from...
Silence goes over the crowd.
Well, silence or people throwing things. The Social Security problem, I think most people recognize, is the simplest problem to describe. The revenue coming in is not sufficient to pay the benefits going out. Ergo, you need to either adjust the spending line, the revenue line, or both.
And it's always the simple things that are the hardest to come up or act on solutions.
It really is, because politically it's so easy to demagogue Social Security. If you're talking about trying to affect the spending line, then you're throwing people on the streets and you want them to eat cat food. And if you're looking at the revenue line, it's you want to kill the economy and it's a socialist blah, blah, blah. So, I mean, everybody's got their talking points to oppose every single action you could take with regard to Social Security. So we asked the Committee for Responsible Federal Budget, who, like the Concord Coalition, doesn't seem to be afraid of offending people. lead author on that was Mark Goldwine at the CRFB, and his co-authors, Maya McGinnis and Chris Towner, looked at a way that you could do those things, but also, you know, some growth strategies with regard to Social Security. So they looked at a way to change the benefit formula to give more credit for all work years. They did look at increasing the eligibility age to encourage longer work, and that gets back into this idea of encouraging growth in the workforce. And they also came up with a very interesting poverty protection benefit at age 62. So this is one of the more difficult conundrums for a lot of Social Security reformers is, you know, how do you gradually increase the eligibility age? You have to phase that in because you can't just wait till people are about to be eligible and then say, oh, guess what, you're going to have to work another year or two. So this plan does not do that. But it also recognizes that there are some people that will spend a whole career and have to retire at 62 just because of the nature of the work that they do. So there is still a possibility of retiring at 62 with a different sort of a benefit formula. And I would encourage people to take a look at what they've done here, because I think it's really interesting. They also included a voluntary savings program. It would be a personal account, but it's not to be confused with prior quote-unquote privatization. This is a way that would encourage people to save and would automatically enroll people in a private savings component of Social Security. It doesn't carve money out of the current system. It would be a so-called add-on, and it is a voluntary part of it. So, look, I think that they've come up with a way of making the system sustainably solvent and encouraging savings and economic growth at the same time.
And I think, personally, when I look at this issue, I'm a proponent of everything should be on the table. But the authors of this particular paper sort of sidestepped that issue and focused on, I think, some more tangible reforms that can be acted on in the near term, and also sort of hold harmless those who are already retired or are about to retire. And I think that is a big chip that should be sort of acknowledged, that it's been taken off the table in general, because what, every baby boomer at this point is at least 55. And I can't think of a policy, an elected leader that has come out and said that anyone from age 55 or older should ever be impacted by these reforms. So I think the entirety of the baby boom generation has been able to escape this idea of reforming the system relatively unscathed. Whether you agree with me or not is different, Bob, but that's my perspective on it. So I actually think millennials and younger generations are going to shoulder most of this particular reform. And you know what? I think I'm okay with it if we're talking about making this a sustainable system long term. This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby. We're discussing Concord's new fiscally responsible economic growth agenda. And Bob just got done sharing with us a little bit about the healthcare and Social Security papers that are key pieces of that particular project. And I want to jump in, Bob, talking a little bit now about the grassroots side of this particular effort. I know you talked in the last segment about some of the forums that have already been done in terms of helping to kick off this program for Concord. What do you see moving forward in terms of how we can engage elected leaders, engage voters as we try and get this information out there?
Well, I think that's really the next phase of the project, the most important thing. We looked at this as establishing sort of an intellectual framework, you might say. These papers, much as I like them, I think policy people will like them. I think media people may like looking through them. I will say they are not exactly grassroots, you know, type of things, because they're kind of deep in the weeds on some of these issues. But the overall concept of fiscal responsibility as part of an economic growth agenda that includes increasing the workforce through legal immigration as one strategy, workforce training, increased federal investment, healthcare spending changes, and Social Security reform. I think that that's our challenge, is to take that agenda and incorporate it into our public education efforts. That will begin primarily next year. I know the authors of these papers are willing to do some traveling, and that's really what the Concord Coalition wants to do, is to pick some key locations, and New Hampshire will certainly be one of them, that emphasizes the themes here and brings in other people, local experts as well as other people from Washington, that want to weigh in on these topics. So these papers are not take it or leave it proposals. They're like, here are five really key issues, here are some potential solutions, but let's look at others and really get a conversation going. I really look forward to tapping into the networks of these authors who are like the R&D people, I mean, that wrote the paper. They have a network of their own, and the workforce people do, and the immigration people do. And that's part of the problem, is that everybody operates in their own silo. And the Concord Coalition is trying to say, look, we need to do all of these things together as part of an economic growth agenda.
Since this is an economic growth agenda, has Concord had this package of plans scored in any way to measure how it might affect economic growth or maybe reduce deficits? Or are we sort of just putting ideas out there to prompt a conversation?
Well, this is the idea phase. However, there's not anybody in the project involved with this that has a question that it wouldn't increase economic growth. I mean, you're looking at things that are universally scored as increasing economic growth. So, but some of the proposals aren't detailed enough to be quote-unquote scored. It is my hope going forward that we will do that. I mean, I do think that one of the things that would help in the next phase of the project is some sort of score. But, you know, when you get into scores, then people start arguing about the methodology of the scoring. And I do think that that's important, because if you're going to have a growth agenda, you want to make sure that it's going to grow the economy. But I don't think I can't think of anybody that would say, gee, if we increase the workforce growth and increase productivity and reduced overall health care costs and made Social Security sustainable, I think you'd get pretty much universal agreement that those things would increase economic growth. The discussion would be on, you know, what's the best way to do that. Now, there's another agenda item that's not in here, and that's overall tax policy. Hmm. And we did not do a tax paper for a couple of reasons. One is, when we were first doing this, Congress had just passed the 2017 tax bill, and we thought, okay, well, there's been a lot of focus on that right now. Let's just let that play out for a little while before we do a tax paper. And the other part of that, too, is that really the purpose of the tax code is to collect sufficient revenues to do that which the government is committed to doing. And it's not really to affect economic growth one way or the other. Now, it can, obviously. So there are parts of this agenda that do affect the tax code. There's like the Social Security authors do recommend raising the cap on the Social Security payroll tax. And there are other proposals that would probably lose revenues to encourage R&D spending by providing a tax break or something like that. So I actually think it's better to focus on what the government should be doing and what it wants to do, what there's a consensus to do, and then figure out the best way to raise sufficient revenue without harming economic growth. So from a policy perspective, that will be in the next phase.
And one more question, Bob, before we go, very briefly. What are you hoping elected leaders and the general public will take from this effort?
I would like people to get across, if there's one message I could get across, is that fiscal responsibility is an economic growth agenda. It is the economic growth and fiscal responsibility are sometimes posed as opposing issues that you can, you know, if you're for fiscal responsibility, you must be for austerity, and that's going to be bad for economic growth. And there's others that think, well, if you're really, you know, trying to stimulate economic growth, that must mean giving money away or, you know, not being fiscally responsible. What we're trying to emphasize is that we need to have a coordinated strategy to increase economic growth, not because it's a magic. We're not going to grow our way out of the problem. We're not trying to stimulate miracle growth here. We're just trying to improve where we are now with the low projected economic growth rates and incorporate that, an economic growth agenda, in a way that is fiscally responsible. And that means sustainable over the long term.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby. We discussed Concord's new fiscally responsible economic growth agenda. Thank you for joining the show, Bob.
Thanks.
We'll be back after these short messages for our final segment, Facing the Facts. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and this is our final segment, Facing the Facts, where I share with you a fact or piece of information that I think is worth you pondering until next week's show. So, it's time to face this fact. A new study on 6 previously identified domains of healthcare waste estimated that the cost of waste in the U.S. healthcare system ranged from $760 billion to $935 billion, accounting for approximately 25% of total healthcare spending. The study by healthcare experts was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association this month. Its goal was to estimate current levels of waste in the U.S. healthcare system in 6 previously identified domains and to report estimates of potential savings for each domain. The study was conducted in large part because the United States spends more on healthcare than any other country, with costs approaching 18% of GDP. Prior studies estimated that approximately 30% of healthcare spending may be considered waste, and the experts believed that despite efforts to reduce overtreatment, improve care, and address overpayment, it is likely that substantial waste in U.S. healthcare spending remains. The 6 domains that were studied included failure of care delivery, failure of care coordination, overtreatment or low-value care, pricing failure, fraud and abuse, and administrative complexity. A search of peer-reviewed and, quote, gray literature from January 2012 to May of 2019 was conducted. Gray literature is unpublished or non-commercial papers like government reports. The review yielded estimates from 54 unique peer-reviewed publications, government-based reports, and other gray literature. The report found the following estimated ranges for the annual cost of waste in each of the 6 domains. For failure of care delivery, it was $102.4 billion to $165.7 billion each year. For failure of care coordination, it was over $27 billion to $78 billion. Overtreatment or low-value care, the waste was estimated at $75.7 billion to over $101 billion. Pricing failure equaled $230 billion to $240.5 billion. Fraud and abuse was estimated at $58.5 billion to $83.9 billion. And administrative complexity was estimated at $265 billion for a total of $760 to $935 billion every year. The estimated annual savings from measures that could eliminate waste totaled $191 to $282 billion. The report also concluded that implementation of effective measures to eliminate waste represents an opportunity to reduce the continued increases in U.S. healthcare expenditures. There's plenty more detail in the report, and I'd suggest you go check it out. You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.